You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. For the rest of the hour, a look inside the often mysterious world of autism through the eyes of someone who has made a career out of overcoming the roadblocks the illness put in her way. Temple Grandin doesn't see the world like most of us do. She does, she would say, see the world more like most animals, a place of fear without emotion, where your thoughts come to you in pictures rather than in words. Temple Grandin is autistic. Her writings about her struggles with autism, her fear, her anxiety, the overwhelming sensation of smell and sound provide an intriguing glimpse into the world of autistic people. Because of her autism, Dr. Grandin says she can understand how animals see the world in a way that most humans cannot. She has written about her experiences with autism and her observations of animals in many books. You may remember her Thinking in Pictures. Well, her latest book is Animals in Translation. I'm sorry. She now joins us. Let me formally introduce her. Temple Grandin is an associate professor of animal science at Colorado State University in Fort Collins. Animals in Translation, Using the Mysteries of Autism to Decode Animal Behavior, is co-authored with Katherine Johnson. She joins us from studios of KPBS in San Diego. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Grandin.
It's good to be here.
How's your book been received?
Well, there's been a lot of interest in it. I was really happy to say that we're making some of the bestseller lists. But let's get into talking about how autism is similar animal behavior. The thing is, I don't think in language, and animals don't think in language. It's sensory-based thinking, thinking in pictures, thinking in smells, thinking in touches. It's putting these sensory-based memories into categories. That's the basis of how an animal would think. And one thing I want to say is animals do have emotion, but fear tends to be one of the most primal emotions.
Mm-hmm. So you don't read animals' minds. I want our listeners to confuse that.
No. And I always get asked all the time about animal communicators, and I really don't want to get into discussing about whether ESP exists or not. Let's just stick with the other more concrete things. That's how I think. I think in most cases, a lot of these animal communicators are very good animal behavior people. And a lot of them are visual thinkers. And they're picking up very subtle body cues from the animal. You know, it's crouching down a little bit. It's moving around a little bit differently. They're just very good at reading animal behavior. And I think in most cases, that can explain some of their successes.
And why do you think your autism allows you to understand how animals think?
Well, to understand animal thinking, you've got to get away from language. See, my mind works like Google for images. You put in a keyword, it brings up pictures. See, language for me narrates the pictures in my mind. When I work on designing livestock equipment, I can test run that equipment in my head like 3D virtual reality. In fact, when I was in college, I used to think that everybody was able to do that. And language just sort of, you know, gives an opinion like, oh, that's a good idea. Or, oh, I just figured out how to design that. Language is not actually used in the actual designing process. That is all done in pictures.
When did you first discover that you could do this? That you could understand how animals think?
The thing is, I thought everybody thought in pictures. When I was in high school and college, I thought everybody could think in pictures. And my first inkling that my thinking was even different was when I was in college and I read an article about some scientist said that the caveman could not have designed tools until they had language. And then when I did Thinking in Pictures, I started interviewing people in detail about how they thought. And that really gave me insight into how my thinking was different and that some people think much more in words. And then I think, well, that has to be how an animal would think. There's no other way an animal could possibly think.
And so you've been able to design devices that animals will readily use as where other people have failed because you can think how they think.
Well, the first thing I just thought about is how they see. I had read in my physiology book that when I was in college that cattle had 360-degree vision. And I was out in the feed yards in Arizona back in the 70s. And, you know, some of the cattle would just walk right up the chutes to get their vaccinations. Other cattle would refuse to go through the chutes. So I got down in the chutes to take pictures of what the cattle were seeing. And people thought that was just kind of crazy. And I found that they were afraid of shadows. They were afraid of a reflection off the bumper of a truck. They were afraid of seeing people up ahead. And if you remove these visual-based details, then the cattle would walk right up the chute. And in the beginning, when I first started doing that, I mean, people just couldn't even see why I was doing it.
Yeah, you write in your book about how you noticed that animals do not like to stand with their legs crossed or feet together, and that some of the pens were forcing them to do that, and you designed that out of it.
Well, that's getting into the restrainer systems that I designed. In the 90s, I designed a system for holding a cattle in the meat plant where they straddle a conveyor. And if you get things set up right, they just walk in really quietly. And you got to get the lighting right. They're afraid of the dark. If the light's going blasting in their eyes like the sun, or there's a reflection on a shiny piece of metal moving, they're going to be afraid of that. And you get rid of those things they're afraid of, you know, then they're going to walk right in. You know, the things that scare a prey species animal like cattle are a whole lot of little visual details that people just don't tend to notice. And one of the big problems we used to have is the people who want to just get out there yell and scream and push and shove and, you know, more and more prods rather than remove the things that the cattle were afraid of.
Mm-hmm. You also talk about animals having special talents, like special talents autistic people may have.
Well, some autistic people have savant skills. All autistic people do not have savant skills. Autism is a very variable disorder, varying all the way from Einstein and brilliant scientists, a little bit of the trait in many scientists and engineers, down to somebody that's going to remain nonverbal. And there is a small segment of people with autism that have savant skills, where they can memorize entire maps of a whole entire city. They can do calendar calculation. And this is similar to some of the skills that animals have. Take bird migration, for example. You know, a Canada goose only has to be shown the route once, and then he remembers the way. And this is sensory-based memory, because if you take a carrier pigeon and you take it somewhere and let it go and then it comes back home again, it remembers the things it sees and smells along the way. But if you put him in a smell-proof, vision-proof box, he's not going to find his way back home.
Right. What about the special powers we think animals have, for example, sensory powers they can predict when an earthquake is coming? We heard stories during the tsunami that the animals knew enough to get out of the way in advance.
Well, I think they're hearing, you know, low-frequency sounds, you know, as the tidal wave is coming in. I mean, they're just animals have very sensitive hearing, and they're hearing those sounds, and they're trying to move away from them, basically.
1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Mike in Ithaca, New York. Hi, welcome to Science
Fair. Hi, Dr. Grandin. Very nice to get a chance to talk to you. First time I was aware of your existence is when you were on Terry Gross's program, and I was thinking, holy mackerel, this person's mind works a lot the way mine does. And then an article about Asperger's syndrome came out in the New York Times, and a friend of mine showed it to me and said, this describes me all over. So I got a bit curious about it, and I read The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, which is a semi-autobiographical account. And I became interested in it, and I found a fascinating website, and I'm wondering if you're aware of it. It's by someone named Andrew Lehman, L-E-H-M-A-N, maybe two N's, and it's called Origins of Autism. It's either originsofautism.com or .org. And in this, he presents the hypothesis that autism is, in fact, an adaptation, not a disorder, that it can go wrong, but when it goes right, it enables people to be more predisposed to have certain kinds of occupations. It's a predisposition, not a predetermination. Any person can get any kind of occupation, but that autistic people tend to be particularly predisposed to do better at certain occupations that include science, inventing, music, dancing, the visual arts and things like this, while people who aren't autistic tend to do better at more practical jobs. Not that each can't do the other's jobs, but they do better with the job their body and brain is more adapted to. And he argued that this adaptation evolved at the time that the bonobos separated from the chimps. He argues the bonobos separated from the regular chimps, and then the bonobo differentiated into the bonobos of today.
Okay, I'd like to comment.
Mike,
I think that, you know, autistic brains tend to be specialized brains. Autistic people tend to be less social. It takes a ton of processor space in the brain to have all those social circuits. I mean, after all, the first stone spear was not designed by the totally social people. Let me just tell you about some research. Some of Simon Baron Cohen's research in England showed that there's 2.5 times as many engineers in the family history of people with autism. I feel very strongly that if you got rid of all of the autistic genetics, you're not going to have any scientists. There'd be no computer people. You'd lose a lot of artists and musicians. There'd be a horrible price to pay. It's like a little bit of the autistic trait can give some advantages. You get too much of the autistic trait, then you get a very severe handicap where the person's going to remain nonverbal. It's a continuum from a severe handicap all the way up to something where it's a personality variant. There's no black and white dividing line between a mild Asperger's, which is the mild autism, and computer engineer, for example.
Well, what do you want people to know or understand most about autistic people? What do you think is most misunderstood about them?
Well, there's a lot of things that are misunderstood. One of the things I want to mention is if you see a child with autistic-like behaviors at age 2 and 3, the worst thing you can do is just let them sit and watch TV all day. That's just the worst thing you can do. You need to have a teacher working with that child, working on teaching language, working on social interaction, working on getting them interested in different things, and keeping their brain connected to the world. Autism is a neurological disorder. It's not caused by bad parenting. It's caused by, you know, abnormal development in the brain. The emotional circuits in the brain are abnormal. And there also are differences in the white matter, which is the brain's computer cables that hook up the different brain departments. This is the research of Dr. Eric Corshane out in San Diego. In fact, in my new edition of Thinking in Pictures, I review this research.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Temple, you credit much of your success to a high school science teacher. Tell us about
yes.
that, please.
Yes, Mr. Carlock. I was a goof-around student who just wasn't interested in school, just didn't want to study, totally bored with school. High school was a disaster. I got kicked out of a large girls' school because I threw a book at a girl after she teased me, and I was sent away to a special boarding school for emotionally disturbed children. You got to remember, this is the 60s. And so they now know that autism's not an emotional disturbance, but they didn't know that in the 60s. And I was still a goof-around student. Now, they had horseback riding, and that was one of my favorite things to do. We had model rocket club. We had electronics club. These were all activities where I could get away from teasing and get in with other students where I had shared interests. You know, people with autism aren't interested in social chit-chat. And Mr. Carlock, I mean, took my interests and used that as a way to motivate me to study science. And, I mean, Mr. Carlock was an extremely important mentor in helping me to develop. And when you look at, let's look at the people with the milder forms of autism that are successful. They have their area of strength, you know, built up on. I have a career that involves using my visual thinking skill for designing. And then mentor teachers, another really, really important thing. Because the autistic brain tends to be a specialist brain. Good at one thing, bad at something else. I'm a visual thinker, really bad at algebra. There's others that are a pattern thinker. These are the music and math minds. They think in patterns instead of pictures. And then there's another type that's not a visual thinker at all, and they're the ones that memorize all of the sports statistics, all of the weather statistics. It's kind of a language logic mind.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. We're talking with Dr. Temple Grandin, author now out in paperback, Animals in Translation, on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Is that what you mean when you say about normal people not being detail-oriented like the way you are and animals are?
Well, the thing is, it's sensory detailed-oriented. You can also have details of words, and there's some details of words that I'm not very good at, but I'm talking about sensory detail, visual detail, detail of some little small sound. I mean, think of all the smell detail that the dog gets. I mean, he checks out the local fire hydrant, and he knows who's been there, when they were there, how long ago they were there, and are they friend or foe. That's a lot of information on the fire hydrant just from different smells.
Yeah, they have to be detail-oriented because that's how they survive.
And that's also how they think. Mm-hmm. And animals actually, you know, can solve problems under new conditions. And And how do you have a think in pictures? Well, you have to sort the pictures into categories. You know, for example, a dog knows that, you know, there's good people and there's bad people. And I talked to a lady the other day where her dog was afraid of people with white beards because she'd adopted him from an animal shelter and somebody with a white beard had abused him. And this dog was now afraid of everybody mm-hmm. that had a white beard. That was the bad category.
I think a lot of people are surprised when they hear you speak and read your writings about your knowledge about how animals think, your sensitivity to their feelings, to learn that you're not a vegetarian.
No, I played around with vegetarianism back in the 70s. For one thing, my physiology just got to have animal protein. I get hypoglycemic. I get all lightheaded unless I eat animal protein. And I did a lot of thinking about this, and I've designed a lot of equipment for meat plants. The cattle would have never been born if we hadn't raised them. And I feel very strongly we've got to give animals a good life. I've worked really hard on improving slaughter plants and animal handling and transport. And people have said to me, why don't you work on improving conditions on pig farms? And basically, to be effective on making real change out there on the ground, you can only work on so many things. You know, you get too distributed, you're not effective. And, you know, I've got my one area I work in, and I want to educate people about autism. And I also want to improve, animal handling and transport and make a real change out in the field on the ground.
Do you have a project you're working on someplace in the country?
Well, right now, I've been just nonstop travel with speaking engagements. At the age of 58 years old, you kind of get to a point in your career where I want to pass my knowledge on. And I've got two big projects coming up. I'm going to be visiting two different universities for a week. I'm going to Cornell University in February as a visiting professor and give talks on animal handling. And I'm kind of at the point where I want to, pass my knowledge on.
Yeah, do you talk to the vets in the vet school there?
Yes. In fact, I've got a meeting lined up with North Carolina State University at their veterinary school, and I'll be talking to the veterinary students at Cornell.
Do you think it's necessary for them to learn about animals before they become vets?
Well, there's a lot, there's a lot of things in animal behavior that vets need to learn about. I mean, just the other day, they thought, I have an assistant named Mark, and we thought that his dog might have a bladder infection, and the vet wanted to take poor Red Dog and throw her on her back and stretch her out on the exam table, no sedatives or anything, stick a needle into her belly for a urine sample. Mm-hmm. And I said, that's too traumatic a thing to do to Red Dog. She's a very, very high-strung dog, and she's likely to be traumatized by that. We're not going to do that. We need a urine sample. We'll get her to pee in a cup.
that's good.
We're not going to traumatize her putting her on her back.
All right, stay with us, Dr. Grandin, and everybody wanting to speak with Dr. Grandin, with Temple Grandin. We're going to take a short break and come right back. Don't go away. I'm Ira Flatto. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatto. We're talking this hour about autism with my guest, Dr. Temple Grandin, Associate Professor of Animal Science at Colorado State University in Fort Collins. Her latest book, out in paperback, Animals in Translation, Using the Mysteries of Autism to Decode Animal Behavior. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Joel in Sacramento. Hi, Joel.
Hello there. It's a privilege to talk to you both. My question is based on the fact that my mother works with autistic students in junior high school and has a difficult challenge because she works in teaching them English, reading, and sometimes math. And the problem that she's observed, and perhaps, Doctor, you may have a comment on this based on your personal experience or study, is the students will often display just what to her seems to be out of nowhere, just this terrible fear. They get terrified, and she cannot get through to them, to the point where often they have to be taken out of the class. And would you perhaps have one or two simple suggestions that my mother could use in calming a student down and directing them to the lesson? Or maybe we're looking at this all wrong.
Okay, let's talk about the fear problem. Fear was my main emotion until I started taking antidepressant medication. And I was one of the people where, as I got older, the fear got worse and worse. So I can really relate to an animal getting, you know, scared and traumatized. Some of these fears these students have are sensory-based. You know, when I was a little kid and a school bell went off, it hurt my ears like a dentist drill. You know, maybe the kid sees a cell phone and the ring on that cell phone hurts that kid's ears. So if he just sees that cell phone, he's going to panic because it's a dangerous thing that might go off. Things like microphones are dangerous things because you never know when they might feed back and squeal. There's a lot of different things that can set off this fear reaction. And I would probably need to talk to your wife a whole lot more to figure out just which situations they're getting the fear reaction in. But a lot of this is sensory. And an adult or child that has a tantrum and just goes ballistic every time you take them in a big supermarket, that is usually due to sensory overload. They may not be able to tolerate the smells in the detergent aisle. The fluorescent lights flicker and make the supermarket look like a discotheque. Or it may be just noise overload and they feel like they're inside the speaker at the rock and roll concert. But these sensory problems are very variable, from really mild to just overwhelmingly bad.
All right, good luck, Joel.
Thank you. We'll take that in and see if we can figure out what it is that is really upsetting them and perhaps remove that from them.
Thank you.
My mother. Thank you.
Good luck.
I'm sorry. It's your mother. Okay, I'm sorry.
Dr. Grandin, what was it that you did that you were able to overcome? You mentioned some medication you were using. What point did you say, I'm going to overcome these fears and these obstacles?
Well, the thing is, autism has all different, you know, variables. And you start out with a certain amount of, you know, there's a point where the differences in the brain are going to just be a personality variant, like for a very mild Asperger's. But you get into more severe kinds of autism where there's obvious speech delay, obvious abnormal behavior in 2- and 3-year-old child. You know, the initial neurology is different from case to case. But all children with autism are going to do better if they get really good educational intervention. And there's a lot of controversy as to which programs you use. I have found that the most important thing is a good teacher. Some teachers just know how to work with a child and get progress, and others don't. And you need lots of hours with a good teacher and these really young kids.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's talk for a bit about something you designed. It was very interesting to read about, called a squeeze machine.
Okay.
Tell us about your squeeze machine.
Well, when puberty hit, that's when the anxiety attacks and the panic attacks started. I was a type of person with autism where once there was puberty, nonstop panic attacks. I mean, imagine how you felt when you did your first really big, important, you know, interview, how nervous you were. Now, imagine if that's the way you felt all the time, all the time. Now, there's other people with Asperger's and autism that don't get nervous. This is where, you know, autism can be very variable. And I was watching cattle go through a squeeze chute for their vaccinations. It's a device they put the cattle in to hold them still. And I noticed that some of the cattle just kind of relaxed. So I went and tried out the squeeze chute. And the pressure calmed me down. Many individuals with autism find that deep pressure applied over large areas of the body has a very, very calming effect on the nervous system. So then I built a squeezing machine that I could get into that worked with an air cylinder and an air compressor where I could work a little control handle and I could squeeze myself, and I used that to calm down. Now, as I got into my 20s, my anxiety got worse and worse and worse. And early 30s, I went on antidepressant medication. I would not be here today if I hadn't gone on that medication. But exercise is another thing that's also very calming. But, this is common.
Do you still have your squeeze box?
I still have my squeeze box. Yes, I do.
Yeah. Okay. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. While we get people on the phone, I want to also ask you about meeting and studying B.F. Skinner. I'm a contemporary of yours, probably about the same age. I remember in college in the 60s, all I studied was B.F. Skinner and his white rats in the boxes running mazes and things. You write a lot about that and also about meeting him.
Well, I want to start out that I was lucky in the 60s to also be taking a class in classical ethology by a professor named Tom Evans, where I learned that operant conditioning does not explain all animal behavior. He explained how fixed action patterns and hardwired instinctual behavior works. And I remember going on a visit to Dr. Skinner, and I felt like I was visiting, you know, the grand temple of psychology. And I went up to his office, and, you know, he seemed like, oh, you mean he's actually an ordinary person? And we got to talking. And, of course, back then I wore a dress, you know, because, you know, ladies had to be, like, dressed up. And I had a very conservative dress on, and B.F. Skinner touched my legs. And I said, you may look at them, but you may not touch them. And that ended that. And then he says, as he was showing me around the rat lab, I said, Dr. Skinner, if we can just learn about the brain, then we really would know some things. And Dr. Skinner says to me, we don't need to know anything about the brain. We have operant conditioning. And I just never really could accept that, you know, especially after taking Tom Evans's class at the same time.
Mm-hmm. And later on, and you're right, he just changed his mind totally on this.
Well, yes. Dr. Rady, I knew him after he had a stroke. And he admitted that maybe he needed to get inside the black box and inside the brain. That yes, the brain did make a difference. But he had to have a stroke in order to realize that.
Mm-hmm. Patricia in Santa Rosa, California. Hi. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi. Hello. Dr. Graydon, it's such an honor to be able to speak with you. I had read your book years ago when I was working at a preschool, and I was really intrigued with the your squeeze machine that you had developed. And I was so grateful to have read that because currently I'm working with a boy who has high-functioning autism or Asperger disorder. And when I first started working with him, I saw that he really needed some deep pressure. He kept hitting his head and he would crash his body into things, and have developed certain ways to have him use language to say how much pressure he needs since we aren't able to make the squeeze machine. But that has made a world of difference in working with him.
That's just wonderful. And another thing where I'm getting very good reports on is therapeutic riding programs. I'm getting lots and lots of great reports from parents on, you know, how beneficial that's been for some children too.
Yes, we considered doing the riding, but he doesn't really like horses.
Okay, well,
but
the thing is,
we had him do swimming, and it's amazing. He loves to go down as deep as he possibly can and stay down there for a moment and then shoot back up.
You know, different things work for different kids because the sensory problems are variable. Like I had auditory sensory problems and touch sensitivity problems. I had no problems with my vision. Other people absolutely cannot stand fluorescent lighting, and they're sometimes helped by a thing called the Erlen-colored glasses, where you try on all kinds of different pale-colored glasses until it's easier to read. It stops the problem of the print jiggling on the page.
How do you spell that?
It's Erlen, I-R-L-E-N.
Okay.
You can also go to...
Yeah. Go ahead.
Sorry.
Okay. Thank you for calling.
Oh, thank you so much.
Have a good weekend and good luck to you.
Thank you.
1-800-989-8255. Dr. Grandin, you say that you almost never think in language, that you think in pictures. So it must be hard for you then to write books like this, I would imagine.
Well, thinking in pictures is totally my writing. And then, of course, all my scientific journal articles I wrote. And my writing is much more technical, formal kind of writing. And thinking in pictures has that. I wrote Animals in Translation with Katherine Johnson. And Katherine Johnson is a super brilliant writer. She has two autistic kids, so she really knows autism. And she was able to write the book, making it like my voice. And I, you know, I really owe Catherine a lot. You know, it wouldn't have been a book without Catherine, because my writing is much more formal. I've got a lot of stuff on my webpage, Grandin.com. That's all my writing. And I think I'm a good technical writer, but I don't know how to write the way Catherine does.
What would you like to do that you haven't been able to do so far in life?
Oh, boy, that's a hard question. One thing I'd like to just keep on doing is I want to educate people about animal behavior and about autism. I've been doing autism talks for the last 20 years, and there still are people out there that do not want to realize, they can't recognize that these sensory problems are real. That for some of these kids, when that fire alarm goes off, that really hurts the ears. It's a really real thing.
Yeah. Well, we've been hearing a lot lately about an autism epidemic. What do you think about that?
I think the mild Asperger's have always been there. You see, Asperger's diagnosis did not become common in the U.S. until the early 90s. And an Asperger's has more or less normal speech development, and they've always been here. That hasn't changed. I can think back to when I was in high school. This is 40 years ago. I could name kids in my high school class and college class that today would be diagnosed as Asperger's. When I go out in the meat industry, there's 40 and 50-year-old undiagnosed Asperger's all over my industry in good jobs like head of maintenance, drawing drawings, fixing equipment, plant engineer. Now, where I think there may be an increase is in some of these more severe forms of autism, especially this type where the kid seems to appear to be normal, and then at 18 months of age or so, he loses language. But I call that the regressive type of autism, and I think that segment's gone up.
There's been a very vocal minority of people who are sure that autism, the rise in autism, has something to do with the mercury preservatives that used to be in vaccinations. Where do you come down on that?
Well, there's actually been some research where they managed to create some mice where when they were given mercury at about the same level as vaccine, they would do some very autistic-like behaviors like biting the ends of their tails. We also need to be watching out for mercury in flu shots given to pregnant moms. And now we get it out of the vaccine, we're going to have mercury in fish from power plant emissions. Mm-hmm. There's also other environmental contaminants that could get in there. I've been reading a lot of things in Science and Nature about endocrine disruptors. These are chemicals that mimic hormones getting into the water supply, and they're already causing some real abnormal things in fish.
Mm-hmm. Are you talking about things that might get into a pregnant woman in utero and causing things that show up later in life, or things that happen from childhood after birth?
Well, I think looking at the research, genetics is probably 60 to 70% of autism. Mm. And in my case, I mean, I'm old enough where I didn't get these vaccines. I'm young enough to have done anything to me. And, my case would have been purely genetic. All the Asperger's around, when I was a kid, were purely genetic. But I think you might be getting some kind of susceptibility that goes with genetics, where maybe they have a very difficult time metabolizing some of these toxins out.
Right.
There's a genetic by environmental interaction.
Mm-hmm. Talking this hour with Temple Grandin, author of Animals in Translation, on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Let's see if we can get a couple of more calls in if we can. Let's go to David in Iowa City, Iowa. Hi, David.
Hello. It's a great pleasure to speak with you, Dr. Grandin. And I have a question about, you mentioned earlier in the show the difference between pattern thinking, people with autism with extraordinary music or math ability versus picture thinking, which is how you've described your abilities. And I'm curious to know whether there are you're familiar with cases of people with autism who have extraordinary pattern, thinking abilities, music, math, and through therapy or intensive instruction, have they been able to develop an extraordinary or at least a normal language ability based on their pattern thinking ability?
Well, one thing that happened with me is they pounded away and pounded away and trying to teach me algebra, and that was just hopeless. And one of the mistakes made in my math education was not going on to trigonometry and geometry. Yes, you can do things, like if you take somebody who's a poor visual thinker and you can work on improving their visual thinking, but you're never going to get them to my state where I can look at a blueprint and I can do a 3D, full motion video of that blueprint. And I've been talking to people that are pattern thinkers, and it's different from me. I was never very good at chess. That was like too abstract for me. What I'm good at is something where I can manipulate photorealistic pictures. And again, I want to emphasize the importance on building on a person's strength. We need to be thinking when these kids are in, junior high school, what are they going to do when they grow up? Because I look at the successful people that have, high-functioning autism and Asperger's. They're ones where maybe the parents were in the computer industry and they just taught the kids programming at, age 8 and 9, and they just went on into the industry with their parents.
So you're worried about the future.
Well, we need to be, I think some of the other countries in some ways may be doing better than we're doing. I went to Japan. That was a little while ago, and I met a lot of Asperger's people over there, and they all had decent jobs.
Mm-hmm. Can you train people to have decent jobs?
Yes, people have to learn social skills. I mean, I had to learn social skills like being in a play. You have to, and this is one advantage that being a child of the 50s was. All children in the 50s were taught manners. They were taught to say please and thank you. They were taught not to be rude. And I'm seeing some problems today where somebody's losing a job because they made fun of a fat lady that couldn't fit in the elevator. Mm. I mean, that was the sort of thing that when I was 8 years old, my mother made it very clear to me that that was not okay to say that kind of stuff.
Well, I want to wish you the best of luck, Dr. Grandin, and thank you very much for taking time to talk with us this hour.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. Temple Grandin, Associate Professor of Animal Science at Colorado State University in Fort Collins. Her latest book is Animals in Translation, Using the Mysteries of Autism to Decode Animal Behavior. A terrific read. I highly recommend it.